Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary Les Castro, chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for tonight's program. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Thomas Donohue, President and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Chamber is the world's largest business organization, representing the interest of more than 3 million businesses of all sizes. Its stated mission is to strengthen the competitiveness of the U.S. economy. Since assuming his position in 1997, Mr. Donohue has built the chamber into one of the nation's most powerful lobbying organizations and has significantly increased its international presence. His stated agenda has included doubling U.S. export, strengthening capital markets, forging a national energy strategy, reinforming healthcare and education, and protecting intellectual property rights. Mr. Donohue also established the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform and the National Chamber Litigation Center, which has challenged in court what has been perceived as anti-business measures. Previously, Mr. Donohue served for 13 years as President and Chief Executive Officer of the American Trucking Association, the national organization of the trucking industry. Mr. Donohue currently serves on two corporate boards of directors, Union Pacific Corporation and Sunrise Senior Living Corporation. He's also president of the Center for International Private Enterprise. Mr. Donohue holds a master's degree in business administration from Adelphi University. Please welcome Thomas Donohue. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm honored and pleased to be here. I will move rather quickly through my remarks so that we can get to what I know will be a spirited question and answer period. I want to thank Gloria Duffy and George Dobbins for inviting me and putting together such a good event. There are some special guests here that I would like to recognize, Steve Falk and Wade Rose from the San Francisco Chamber are here, and they've been strong partners with the U.S. Chamber on many issues, particularly the ones we agree on. They certainly are. In addition to having many friends in the audience, this is somewhat of a homecoming. I've done this homecoming many times, but Mrs. Donohue and I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area so long ago I can't remember when I was Assistant Postmaster General and was working in the activities in the 14 western states. And we lived down in Foster City, and our youngest son was born here, who is now old enough to have three of his own children. But it's a wonderful time to come back, and I thank you very much. We can learn a lot of lessons in the United States from California experiences, for good and for bad. And while these are difficult times for the state, I don't buy the argument that California's best days are behind them. And more than I believe that that's the circumstance with our own country. You hear that a lot around, but don't believe it. I recently told a group of Chinese people from their government, you can't make any money betting against the United States. I think they're beginning to believe it. California and the nation have tremendous strengths, but our continued success is not preordained. With all of our blessings, it is indeed entirely possible to screw it up. Some would say that we're doing a pretty good job of that right now. We live in a competitive world, and no amount of denial can change that reality. People, ideas, innovations, and capital will go where they are welcome, where they will have a fair shot at success, and where they are safe. Both California and the nation have huge populations and consumer markets. Our demographics are attractive, and many of our competitors are not as attractive. Many of our policymakers have become complacent because of those issues in light of the fact. We are too big to ignore, they say. Guess again, we can be ignored. Sure, as long as there are customers with money, someone will be willing to sell them something or to buy something. But will they make it here? Will they invent it here? Will they hire here? Will they headquarter here? Will they pay taxes here? Will they continue to send their children to study here? Will the tourists and entrepreneurs still choose to come here? A serious question for this state and for our nation. These are the questions that really matter. And if you want to answer to all of them, the above would be a positive answer, would be a resounding yes. Then California and the nation must start facing up to some fundamental competitive challenges and economic realities. Our single greatest challenge, in my opinion, is generating faster and stronger economic growth to employ millions of Americans, to fund essential public services, and to care for the growing legions of older people now that 10,000 baby boomers a day are starting to retire. That's 70,000 a week. The number sort of levels off because there's a good number of people that are passing on to their just desserts. In fact, despite recent signs of hope, we expect the economy to actually slow down in the coming months. We're not forecasting another recession. America is beyond that, I believe. But our economists, who are pretty good at this, think that the 2.8% economic growth we had in the fourth quarter of last year will settle back to 2+% in the first half of this year before picking up a little more steam later in the year. Now, that presumes that we are able to manage the many known and unknown trouble spots around the world. And it doesn't calculate what would happen if gas prices continue to spiral upwards, if Europe goes into a serious decline, and if the Mideast erupts. There are many downside risks to what is, at best, a tepid growth forecast. But there is also, and the Federal Reserve said this, we can err on the upside or the downside. I certainly would rather err on the upside. We can grow our economy faster and stronger if we make the right choices, if we remove some of the impediments and uncertainties, and if we face up to some tough fiscal truths that have been ignored for too long. It's the upside potential that I would like to focus on this evening. In fact, I believe we have a phenomenal opportunity across this country and this state to fundamentally strengthen our economy and put millions of Americans back to work without significantly raising taxes or adding to the deficit. So let's talk about how to do that. Let's start with a big idea, energy. We say in one of our publications that the last big idea happened in this state, in Silicon Valley. We believe the next great idea is energy. Energy, in fact, is a game changer for the U.S. With the right policies, the oil and natural gas industry and others could create more than 1 million jobs in the next 7 or 8 years. Many, many more, in fact. Other states across the country see new boom coming, and they are jumping at the opportunity. North Dakota has an unemployment rate of just over 3%. I often caution my colleagues, it may be because a lot of people don't want to live there. But the fact is, they have this low unemployment rate, and they're looking to hire more people. And do you think it's because, as I said, of the warm weather and sunny climate? Not at all. It's, in fact, because of energy. Energy has been and can once again be a tremendous strength in our country, and particularly in California. A key choice facing this state when it comes to energy, or is it content to simply control, tax, regulate, and ultimately ration energy? excuse me, pages occasionally stick together. Choosing the first course means growth. It means jobs, and it means competitiveness. Choosing the second course is a clear prescription for further economic decline. Think about this. The Golden State leads the nation in renewable energy sources. It's home to 17 of the nation's 100th largest oil fields. It has two nuclear power plants. Citizens and businesses alike have set the national pace when it comes to energy efficiency. Let me say that again. If this state wants to point to one significant thing that they have done that has made a big difference here, is energy efficiency. Meant in English, you use a much less energy to create a similar amount of power. The most economically viable alternate energy is, of course, efficiency. Yet despite such leadership and resources, California holds the dubious distinction of being the nation's leader in importing energy from other states. Gas and power prices are through the roof, hurting the consumers and driving businesses and jobs away. The impending tax on power generation and energy use that will soon come courtesy of AB 32 promises to make, I'm told, a bad situation worse. Now, there will be an energy revolution in this country. At the chamber, we're doing everything possible to help make it happen. We're fighting for faster permits, for opening more federal lands and offshore areas for development, and we're fighting for the Keystone XL pipeline. It must be an all-of-the-above energy revolution. Green energy, existing energy, and new energy. The production of more power must more cleanly and more safely than ever before, with unprecedented gains in efficiency through innovation, should be our overall objective. It will create, by the way, millions of jobs. It will set our nation free from the grip of some unfriendly suppliers, and it will generate tens of billions of dollars in new revenues at the federal, state, and local levels for schools, for infrastructure, for deficit reduction, and other essential services. The serious question facing citizens and their leaders here is whether you want to be a part of this and enjoy the benefits, or should we all the benefits go to other states? Remember, opportunity moves to where it will work. Expanding American energy is just one part of a broader effort to modernize the nation's entire physical platform. No one has to tell the people of California about the frustration and the cost of an inadequate, overburdened infrastructure. We can create jobs, improve the quality of life, attract new industries and visitors, clean the air and save lives by modernizing our transportation and other infrastructure systems. We're very pleased that after years of needless delay, the Congress approved a multi-year FAA reauthorization. Lawmakers now need to pass legislation to maintain investments in our roads, our bridges, and our transit systems. Both the House and the Senate are right now considering decent bills. They need to get them passed so we can go to conference, get the best possible growth, and begin generating jobs and growth both here and across the nation. The package should at least maintain current funding levels over a number of years for highway and transit and special projects development, and encourage more private sector investments in infrastructure. In fact, right now there's $250 billion, $250 billion worth of private funds ready to get into the infrastructure if we can get a highway bill and a bill that runs for more than a couple of months, because only then will the states and local communities be able to put their money to work. So let's talk about what we would do next. There's another area of tremendous opportunity for California and the country. Expand trade, expand investment, and let's expand tourism. Nowhere are opportunities greater for those issues than here in California. The state's economy became the eighth largest in the world, mostly because it is such a gigantic global trader. its location, its ports, its productive diversity, its strong immigrant communities, and its positive international brand will help to do a lot more global business in the years to come. But we must have a bold and aggressive trade agenda. After all, 95% of the people that this country wants to sell something to live outside this country. We're pushing the administration to build on the successful conclusion of a free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. And the reason we finally voted them is because the EU and Canada had negotiated these arrangements, and we were losing jobs every week to that arrangement. A great way to start to move forward is by completing a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, we call it TPP, in the booming Pacific Basin. California's largest export market can be a lot larger and a lot more attractive if we're not paying those taxes and those tariffs. Let's get a high-quality agreement done this year. The Chamber has proposed a new transatlantic economic and trade pact with the European Union. By the way, they are our largest export market. They are China's largest export market. They are in a bit of trouble, but we need to make a better agreement with them that will drive the economy and give us an opportunity to build and expand our own GDP. And we must not overlook the extraordinary benefits of expanding tourism and business travel to the United States. When people come here and bring their money, it's like exporting a product overseas. They come, they have a good time, they get a good feeling about where they're visiting, and they leave their cash. We like that, and we need to do more of it. California is a prime destination for travelers, and the California legislators, both in the state and in the Congress, should work hard to help move this forward. We need to lay out the welcome mat to foreign visitors and make it easier for them to spend their money here. And by the way, as I said, that's another export. We need to broaden the visa waiver programs, limit wait times at customs, and implement travel-trusted programs to reduce the hassle, which jeopardize, and by the way, we cannot jeopardize safety or the safety of this country, but simply restoring our share of the travel market to the 2001 level would realize about $900 billion in economic stimulus and create 1.3 million new jobs in this country in a big hurry and at no cost to the taxpayers. The next subject, and I'll get to the end quickly because I can see all these questions, the next subject to grow our economy and create jobs, we need sufficient and serious, legal and regulatory reform. The regulatory avalanche confronting our job creators is unprecedented in my long experience. The Labor Department has 100 rulemakings going on right now, which will change the way you hire, pay, and employ people. The Dodd-Frank bill, which everybody thinks has some value, requires 447 rulemakings, 63 reports, and 59 studies. My little grandchildren will be concluding that stuff, maybe. And the health care law establishes 159 new agencies, panels, commissions, and regulatory bodies. I'm tired already. The Environmental Protection Agency has 200 regulations in process. Pardon me, and the business community must contend with a National Labor Relations Board that is clearly tilted towards a union agenda. Can anyone honestly claim that we need all those additional government regulations in order to protect the health and safety of the public and make sure the economic rules of the road are fair? We need clearly to modernize and overhaul the regulatory system while seeking specific relief as new rules are written. That's what the Chamber is doing every day in Washington, before the regulatory agencies, before the Congress, and in the courts. Meanwhile, our Institute for Legal Reform is fighting frivolous lawsuits, opposing third-party financing of litigation, actually financing it and wanting to get a profit out of it, and working for a simpler, faster, and fairer system. Legal reform is particularly important in this state. The state's legal climate rated 46 in the 2010 Harris Interactive Survey of state legal climates. Not a very good idea. And excessive regulations and lawsuits continue to send California businesses packing to go somewhere else, and they are preventing new businesses from operating and expanding. So let's wrap up here. We need to think about an innovative agenda in this country, an innovation agenda. How do we maintain and advance America's leadership as the most innovative society on earth? We're still number one, you know, but we're in danger of losing that edge. We can maintain our leadership by better protecting our intellectual property, the things we invent. 19 million Americans, including millions of Californians, work in our innovative industries. Congress took an important step last year by passing a long overdue patent reform legislation, and now we're working to find reasonable common sense solutions to the dangerous problem of rogue internet sites. We supported legislation, which you probably heard about, to crack down on these rogue sites. We appreciate that some people were sincerely concerned about how the language in the legislation, as it was concluded, might be interpreted and used by the government, and so were we. Censorship was not and cannot be the objective. We all benefit from a vibrant and open internet. We also share the goal of safe and a legal internet. Police would close down a store down the street selling stolen goods, and no one considers that censorship. Yet when these stolen goods are sold online, the rallying cry in opposition across the web was censorship. Rogue websites support foreign criminals selling counterfeit pharmaceuticals, baby formula, auto and airplane parts, and movies and CDs to unknowing Americans. And left alone, they will simply proliferate, placing more and more consumers and employers at risk, costing the state and the federal government revenue and putting people out of work. Now, I hope you agree with me that we all share some responsibility to help come up with a constructive solution to the growing problem that not only costs jobs, but costs lives. There are other actions we must take to maintain our lead in innovation. We must reform our visa policies to ensure we attract and retain the brightest minds in the world. We must reform our immigration system because America's prosperity has always depended on hard work, sacrifice, drive, and the dreams of immigrants. We must make substantial improvements in our K-12 public schools, overhaul job training programs, and foster close cooperation among our universities and our businesses to up the skills of our workers. There's one more priority I'd like to raise, and that is we urgently need to push spending control and get our deficits and growth under control while we're outgrowing this economy. There's no point in growing it on one end and leaking it out on the other. And you can keep these important programs with a few small adjustments. The United States has racked up $5 trillion in debt in the last 4 years. Our total national debt has just surpassed 100% of our national income, our GDP. California's fiscal picture is at least as bleak. Chronic budget shortfalls, large bond indebtedness, huge unfunded liabilities, and a tax burden that is already among the nation's highest. I've spent much of my remarks this evening talking about the imperative of economic growth. We must have stronger and faster private sector growth in order to create jobs and generate revenues to pay for the needs of this society. But as important as growth is, it cannot by itself restore California and the nation to fiscal responsibility. There is only one plausible way to do that: end the addiction to spending and reform the long-term obligations that are simply unsustainable no matter how fast we might grow the economy or how many taxes we might try and raise. Washington is not setting a very good example, I might say. With some exceptions, leaders there have ignored the bipartisan recommendations of several commissions. Those who dare to suggest we would reform entitlements, not get rid of them, but modestly reform them in order to save them, are viciously attacked. And rather than cut spending, the new rallying cry in the Capitol is that we can solve our fiscal and economic problems simply by raising taxes on our wealthier Americans and our most successful small businesses and core industries. As we debate taxes, it is important to keep one reality in mind. As of January 1st, without a single vote, the Congress or the signature of the Congress or a signature of the President, federal taxes will automatically go back up by $5 trillion over the next 10 years. And, by the way, 51 to 52% of our country pays no federal income tax. Every tax you can imagine, income rates are at all-time levels. The child care credit, the death tax, the payroll tax, and the capital gains and dividend taxes are going to go up at the first of the year. Now, nobody thinks all these tax hikes are actually going to occur because the Congress is smarter than that. But few can see a clear path to how the current rates get extended beyond the election or in a rush lame duck session after the election. But those impending trillions of dollars in federal tax hikes are worth thinking about here in California, especially if voters are asked to consider major state tax increases that might be placed on the ballot through this initiative program. You put all that together, you're talking about $2 trillion a year. You think you have a weak economy now? Imagine the combined impact of all those new taxes, taxes that would surely fall heavily on our most productive workers, investors, and businesses. Those are precisely the taxpayers which California relies on most heavily to support the entire public sector. Neither Washington nor Sacramento can tax their way out of this fiscal crisis. When you have an addiction to spending, no amount of new money is ever enough. So we've got to break that addiction. And we must reform entitlements on the federal level and reform public employee pensions on the state level. Bankruptcy and economic decline wait for us if we fail. So now is my conclusion, ladies and gentlemen. Let me underscore that America's most pressing economic challenge is the lack of sufficient growth, and that our most compelling government challenge is to control public spending. How are we going to create the political will, the pressure, the courage to make all this happen? Well, in the case you hadn't heard, there's going to be a big election in November in which voters will have a clear choice. The chamber does not get involved in endorsing, funding, supporting, or dealing with candidates for the presidency, although we're very engaged in many of the issues that will be discussed with the presidential campaign. We do, however, conduct one of the nation's largest voter education programs for the House and the Senate, as well as some of the elections for attorneys general and state Supreme Court justices. And while we respect these business groups and chambers that choose to make their voice heard in other ways, we will make no apology for what in 2012 will be our largest and most aggressive voter education effort. The single most important issue for the business community in this election is how to best defend, protect, and advance a free enterprise system that is so critical to our national economic success and such a defining part of who we are. We must not lose the spirit of enterprise and risk-taking that has served this country and this state so well. The business community has a fundamental duty to stand up for one economic system that can restore our nation to growth, prosperity, and opportunity, and that's the free enterprise system. If we don't, who will? Now listen, this is not a perfect system, but no one has ever found a better one for lifting people out of poverty, for inspiring hard work and creativity and personal responsibility, for generating dynamic growth that is broadly shared, and for keeping the American dream alive for generation after generation. So as the Chamber turns 100 years old this year, in this pivotal year, we are reaffirming our commitment to free enterprise and limited growth of government, the best economic formula ever devised, and the driver of America's greatness. For all who care about the future of this wonderful state and our great country, there is no time now to sit around and see what happens. We have to stand up and make things happen. So I want to thank you again, both those that are here and those that are watching, for inviting me and for considering my views. I'm looking forward to the questions on various subjects that I have raised and that you will raise, and I want to thank you for inviting me back again. I thoroughly appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, our thanks to Thomas Donohue, President and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I'm Richard Waters, West Coast editor of the Financial Times, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Mr. Donohue, we have a lot of questions stacking up here, so let's dive.
We're doing fast.
Let's dive straight in. Now, you presented economic growth as the single biggest issue that U.S. business and the U.S. economy faces. For a lot of the audience who are listening today, the biggest issue for them will be jobs. Now, the two are obviously very closely related. But right now, we're at a period where American businesses are as profitable or more profitable than ever, where the cash position of businesses is incredibly strong. This is a period when historically you would expect employment to be rising, and it's not. So what's gone wrong? Why aren't your members hiring more, and what's going to get them started?
Well, I think you would have to look at three issues. First of all, there's no question that economic growth has been much lower than it was. It has been down in the 2% ranges, and we're doing better than most people around the world where we also sell stuff. It is now perking up a little bit, and you see American companies beginning to hire people. So jobs are very simple. You want to put people back to work, you need an economic growth that is north of 3% for an extended period of time, and you will create more jobs. Second, the reason a lot of these companies are sitting on a lot of that cash is, you remember I read off all those new regulations in healthcare and capital markets and the environment and in labor. They are only beginning to figure out what that costs, and they want some cash to get through that. And third, while they are making decent profits because they worked real hard to drive down their expenses, until they get more consumer demand both here and around the world, you're not going to see them spend a good deal of that money. The bottom line is, I think their nose is coming out from under the tent. I think we're going to make progress if we can move to make some of this regulatory change, to adopt what we want to do on the energy side and the infrastructure side. I think with some luck and some movement in the right direction, you will find a year from now, year and a half from now, things will be much different.
Regulation is something that is always with us, and forgive me, but businesses always complain of regulation. That's as the sun always shines. But it takes historically, it's taken business leadership to put an emphasis back on jobs. Henry Ford, you know, argued that you had to put money in workers' pockets, or you won't get that demand that you say needs to come. And it doesn't seem that there's any real leadership in business now to push that case in the same way. I mean, are American businesses failing to represent their social responsibilities right now? Because a lot of people seem to think they are.
Well, I'm sure if you're looking for a job, people might think that. But there are three or four things to look at. If you break it down by industry, if you look at parts of the healthcare industry, if you look at parts of the folks right here in the Valley who are working on the social media and all that sort of thing, they're hiring people like it's going out of style. So it just supports the fundamental issue that if you have demand, if you have growth in your sector, you're going to hire more people. If you don't, you're going to hold on to your capital and wait till you see the consumer coming back. If you don't do that and you're running a company, after a while you find somebody else running the company.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Thomas Donohue, President and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who is discussing the state of American business in 2012. A couple of questions from our audience on a similar theme. One here is, how can U.S. workers possibly compete with hundreds of millions of low-wage workers who are increasingly available on the global labor market?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, I hear people all over the United States talking about, why don't we make anything anymore? Well, it's very interesting. We are still the largest manufacturer in the world, bigger than China, and at a much higher level in the technology and the sophistication of what we make. Now, the people that are complaining about that have a legitimate issue, because our efficiency in supply chain management, the use of information technology and robotics allowed us to peel about 20% of the cost of manufacturing out of the system. And we have to do that to compete globally. And those jobs are never coming back, because who would ever go back to building cars like Henry Ford? Look at what happened with our own automobile industry. They had to modernize to compete. But we're still a huge manufacturer. We still have great opportunity if we can pick up our economy, add some economic growth, but more important, innovate. You know how many millions of people you could hire if we would go forward with the energy agenda that I talked about in the beginning of my remarks, and it is clear as day that if we do that, we would win on the job creation, we would win on economic growth, we would win on global security, and we have just got to have the will to step up and do it.
When you think about businesses' responsibilities towards workers, do you think, and this is a question from the audience, do you think American businesses have a responsibility to their workers? And a related question, do you attribute the declining working conditions in the U.S. to a decline in unionization?
I think business leaders have a responsibility to their constituents. And their constituents are their shareholders that put up the money so the companies could grow, expand, and be in business. Their workers, who are fundamental to the producing the product or service, and their customers, who are fickle. And are going to go, I mean that respectfully, they are going to go to the companies that, and wherever those companies are, that give them the best deal and the best service and the best quality. And it is not that if I'm running a major company, or I run a major, to whom am I responsible? I'm responsible to my investors, I'm responsible to my members, I'm responsible to my workers, I'm responsible to the people that we serve, and you can't pick one. If you don't serve your members, you don't have the resources. If you don't serve your workers, you can't serve your members. And if you don't serve your country by making your contribution, whatever it happens to be, you're not going to be in an environment where you can expand. So I'm not ducking your question. You can't duck your responsibility to workers, but you can't keep people who are either not productive or in a company that is not able to stay in business because they can't compete. And we need to understand the absolute independence and essential role of the investor, of the worker, and of the customer.
A last question on jobs. We've talked about international competition for jobs, but in this election cycle, we're hearing a lot about job creation in Texas or Massachusetts, and it's raising this question of national competition for jobs. It seems to be a zero-sum game.
That is a really great question. I love that question. I was not long ago up in Massachusetts and in Michigan in a single day, and I was hearing from workers and others about all these jobs that were going overseas. And I said, those jobs didn't go overseas. Those jobs had gone to Texas and Arizona and California. You know, it's better weather, cheaper energy costs in a lot of ways. And by the way, does this state have a group of people, both in the private and public sector, that are trying to attract investment and companies to come from other places in the United States and come and operate here in California? You're damn right they do, because it is a competitive environment. And one of the things that gets companies to figure out where they're going to go is, where is a competitive workforce? And the big issue today is, how do we get an educated workforce? There are 3.5 million jobs in this country right now today going empty because we can't find the workers to fill those jobs with the skills and sometimes the ability to move where those jobs are.
Let's move on to regulation. You talked a lot about excessive regulation. A question from the audience on California's AB 32, global warming mandate, is that, you know, it's taken that regulation to put California in the lead on a lot of newer energy technologies. So isn't this an example of how regulation actually is needed to actually open up these new markets that represent the future of American energy?
I'm going to answer that question. I want to preface it. I talked about all the regulations in healthcare and capital markets and labor and environment, and I would like to compare them for a minute to previous regulations. We're going through a regulatory tsunami right now. It is unbelievable. When we did some of the previous issues in capital markets regulation, Sarbanes-Oxley, many of you remember that. That regulation took 16 rulemakings to make it happen. Dodd-Frank will take more than 250 rulemakings. The 16 rulemakings took almost 3 years to do. You can do the math. What we're faced with, the regulations that I indicated to you, is something that will shut down the system, not speed it up. Now, when you come to California's environmental regulations, you're historic in this state, and you've done a great deal about efficiency. You're very engaged in green energy, and that's a very good thing to do. But the fundamental reality is, will it create growth or will it impede growth? Because right now, we need growth and we need jobs. Growth plus jobs equals funds to pay people. It equals tremendous opportunity to take care of our national and our state debt, and tremendous opportunity to deal with the fundamental realities that we have in entitlements that are coming on us in a much more aggressive way than we have ever seen. Regulation is needed. Regulation exists. We have so many regulations in state and local governments, you can't even find them all. But what's going on right now in this country is a system where government knows best, and government is going to regulate all of the things we do until we don't do anything.
Many people would say that it was excessive deregulation in the financial system in the 90s, particularly the repeal of Glass-Steagall, that led to a lot of the risk-taking that we've seen in the last few years. And actually, you know, what's needed now is a much stronger re-regulation in the wake of this collapse. Dodd-Frank has come in, but, you know, but the most stringent part of that, the Volcker Rule, hasn't yet been implemented. So how can you say that actually, you know, we're struggling under too much regulation now?
Well, it's all going to be there. There are going to be two, unless, and some of them are changing, by the way. They're not going to do the derivative thing. Everybody, including Barney Frank, voted against it. He said, this is wrong. We have to fix it. So, but there are 250-some-odd regulations that people are moving on. And with all the effect that we've already had, we've only done 12 or 15% of those regulations. We have a long, long way to go. And what we're saying, we should look at every one of them. Does it provide a protection that we need? Or does it put restrictions that are so difficult that companies that are financial companies, banks and investment institutions and others, are going to be limited in the amount of money they can provide for investment with small companies, with large companies, with individuals with ideas? I mean, no question that the housing thing was not a very attractive thing we're watching. It did not come out as was intended. This whole thing, you know, originally started with the Congress, who insisted back in the savings and loan crisis years ago, insisted that we securitize all of those mortgages, and we have been paying the price for not doing it well. That doesn't mean that you should come back and give the people, the systems that work, the same treatment that you give the systems or the people that don't work. If you do that, you kill the goose that lays the golden egg, and there are no more golden eggs.
Well, on a related question, and I'm going to paraphrase a number of questions that are coming in from the audience. Good. On this point, the related question of governance and how businesses are run, not much has changed in the wake of the financial meltdown. There is still a sense that chief executives pay themselves too much and still have a lot of power and don't recognize the interests that you mentioned before, the workers and so on. So what has actually changed in the governance of American companies to give people confidence that we won't suffer a crisis like this again?
Well, first of all, let's just talk about the financial community. I will answer your question because I want to. You know, the first president of the United States to help the financial industry was George Washington. And we have done it 6 or 7 times or more since then, as need dictated. In every single instance, including this one, the government of the United States made a profit, and sometimes a rather usurious profit, on their investments in the problems of the financial community. And they have gotten back far more than they have put out on this issue. Still a few people to collect from, but net-net, they've already collected back more than they ever put out. Second, I think companies, as they have done in each other times, have learned a great deal from this. Do they pay their executives too much? Some places. You have 17,000 public companies in this country. They're not all, some of them are on the pink sheets. They're not. You can't find them. They're small ones. And would you say that 1% of them, which is what, 170,000 of them or something like that, maybe have a problem? Yeah, maybe 1% of them. And I always look when people say, do we pay these guys too much? And as you noted, I'm on 2 major corporate boards. I don't know. Finding a CEO is much more difficult than finding a top-notch point guard for a professional basketball team.
Say the CEOs would have us believe, yes.
Well, because I have hired a number of them, I will tell you it is very, very complicated. It was the federal government that pressed the business community to go to stock options and other things so that they could be that executives could be paid on the performance of the company. Who was to say that over the last 3 decades that we would have that massive growth in the stock market, and they benefit from it? But I'll tell you, there is now much more careful look at what we pay people, and it is much more open to public scrutiny. And the bottom line is it's still very, very hard to run a big company. You either make the money, you reach the numbers, or you're gone, which is not true in very many places in this country.
You're often gone with $20 million in your pocket. But let's move on to climate.
Wait a minute. Oh, while you're doing that, as you're advancing your view on this, the point is, and this is what's fundamentally unfair, many of those people leave after 33 years or something at the company. They've kept all their stock in there. They've kept all their savings accounts in there. They've got their pensions in there. And that adds up to a lot of money. You know what I'm telling people to do? I think it's time to reconsider whether you're going to hold it all or turn it over at much, much lower numbers as you go on. It's a good question.
Let's move on to energy, because we've got a lot of questions about energy. And let me boil this down to 3 questions. One is, do you personally believe in global warming?
I believe in some of it. I don't believe in some of the arguments that have not yet proven in any fashion. I do believe we spent trillions of dollars in this country to clean the air from lead and all of those pollutants, I think there are things that one has to do to think about the global warming thing, and we've come halfway there in making extraordinary progress by using efficiency to get twice the energy out of half of the input, and I believe that's worth doing. It's a damn good hedge, and I support it.
You talked earlier about the Keystone pipeline, the importance of opening that up. Of course, that will open up access to tar sands and to will encourage fracking, which is obviously a very controversial theme right now. One of the questions from the audience, climate scientist James Hansen has said that additional emissions from this process mean it's basically game over for the for the climate. So if that's the case, how can you support the pipeline?
I support the pipeline for three reasons. First of all, that energy is going to be taken out of the ground in Canada. I've been there, by the way. Most people haven't. And it's going to be sold either here in the United States, and there are no closer friends than we have but the Canadians, or it's going to be sold in China and other places around the world, and we ought to take advantage of it. And it's going to be, by the way, you know, where they're going to build it, there are about 22 or 23 pipelines that run in the same deal. But this one is very important because where it starts, where it goes along in Texas and other places and down into the Gulf, and it is a smart thing to do if you believe you want to create jobs, you want to create economic growth, you want to be able to go out and employ more people, and you want to begin to pay down debt. And I'm all for it. And by the way, the State Department was for it. Everybody was for it until we came to a presidential election.
This is obviously an extremely divisive issue amongst your own members. Apple resigned from the chamber over climate issues a couple of years ago. I've had a few questions here from the audience on this one. One is, you know, why does the chamber pursue a carbon policy that 99% of your members don't benefit from?
First of all, the chamber doesn't have a carbon policy that 99% of our members don't benefit from. The chamber, by the way, has 300,000 corporate members, and through our state and local chambers, we represent about 3 million people. We had, in that time when Apple resigned, and I'll point out Al Gore's on the Apple board, when Apple resigned over, maybe it was that issue, three companies resigned. The other two stood under the bill that was, and I would have resigned if I were them, that was coming out of the House and going to the Senate to benefit $1 billion a year in subsidies for their nuclear power plants if the chamber was not successful in stopping what I think would have been a backbreaking bill going through the Senate. So I'm not particularly worried that we're going to lose a lot of members. And I don't believe you could ever say that 99% of my members are going to be hurt by looking for a balanced program. We have supported more than 350 green energy projects, many of which have never been done because not in my backyard, not in my town, not in my country, and because certain union groups weren't going to get the jobs. All these things never get done. We were the first one to support them.
We're in an election year.
I noticed.
You mentioned that in the last election cycle you spent a lot of money, and you're going to spend a lot this time around. 2 years ago, $50 million, which I think was 20-30% more than the previous cycle. So how much is it going to be this time?
Well, first of all, I've never said it was $50 million. That's what the press said. It could have been less, could have been more. So this time it could be less and it could be more. But actually, I think we'll spend a little more.
A lot of people are concerned about this exercise of corporate and business influence through donations now and believe that the system is out of control.
Are they concerned about the millions and millions and millions of dollars that unions put into these elections? I had a fascinating experience, by the way. I was in Copenhagen, you know, that's a little place. And this guy was giving me a terrible deal about how much money we spend on the elections. And I said, look, let me tell you something. Copenhagen's a wonderful place. It's just a part of we pick any small state in the United States and you're a fraction of its size. And we've got 50 states and a massive country with more than 300 million people. And it costs a little money to get the deal out. Besides, and you'll take this in good spirit, you know, this is one thing that keeps a lot of the newspapers and television stations going every 2 years by all of the ads we buy, all the stories we write, all the monies we invest. So you guys ought to stop knocking what we spend, because if we ever stop spending it, I think you'd be in real trouble.
Does this arms race between business and unions ever end, or does it just escalate?
I don't know. I find ourselves working together on a lot of things. The unions, many of the construction unions, are supporting our activity in trying to get the pipeline done and infrastructure.
I mean in campaign funding and or voter education funding in your case.
Yeah. You know what the great thing about this country is? Then anybody can run for president. You don't have to come out of a rich family. You don't have to be somebody that is being ordained by the political system to be in a system that controls the elections. And if you look at the candidates that we've had over the last years, people that come from modest means, people that come from modest backgrounds, and sure, some people have had a lot of money, but that's the great thing about this country. You're free to succeed or fail based on your efforts and your luck. I don't think it's a war. I think it is an argument over ideas. It's an argument about what we think our country should be like, what we want for our children and our grandchildren. And I think every 2 years spending a small amount of money in relation to a $15 trillion economy, spending a couple of billion dollars on a massive 2 year long, it seems to me, election, isn't the worst thing in the world. And I will do everything I can to protect people's constitutional right to participate in the process of petitioning the government.
An audience member asks, is the chamber committed to any one candidate for president? And
Absolutely not.
What's at stake in the Republican primaries right now for you and for U.S. business?
Listen, I've been up here for a long time. I haven't ducked a question yet, have I? No, I think it's very, very important that we get somebody that, should they be elected, could lead this country. And whoever is elected, we, of course, will participate with and support. The reason we don't participate in presidential politics is because we operate all around the world, and you can only have one president, you can only have one State Department, you can only have one Defense Department.
This is definitely ducking the question.
Yes,
but
thank you
off on that one.
I tried to do it as best I could.
Let's move on to the issue of taxation, which you talked a little about. President Obama is proposing a change to corporate tax, and that's something that U.S. companies have obviously been pushing for a long time. The headline number sounds quite significant. He wants to bring the rate down from 35 to 28%, and he wants to even the system out more, fewer loopholes. Is this a good thing?
Well, first of all the president's been putting out a lot of issues. You know, he put out his State of the Union deal. He put out a major, major issue on budgets and deficits and, well, they didn't say much about deficits and his budget arrangement. And then he just put out this thing we're all looking at today. Now, the deal he put out for today was the beginner discussion. It's a very interesting discussion. It would drop the corporate rate to 28. By the way, we are the only country in the world, major country, who doesn't have a territorial tax. So when we do something overseas, we pay the tax twice. So we're double taxed, and we're still competitive. The problem is you have to read the second and third and fourth deal. The other things he had to say today were, for example, that while that rate would go down, the rate on dividends, what we would pay on dividends and capital gains, would go up significantly, and that he would take away almost all of the deductions. And I have to tell you, I could go around this room and find out a lot of deductions that corporations take, and eventually he's talking about individuals in higher income areas, and higher income starts at $200,000. When you take all of those things away, the people in this room are going to be madder than hell. And I find it very interesting to do taxes. It's another thing I could duck if I could get away with it, for the simple reason that Everybody, all the people that run companies, all the individuals, they say, we want to make a tax adjustment. We're willing to get rid of those write-offs. There are already 20 rump groups coming to visit us to say, you're right. But there are just three things you have to be careful. If we keep these three, then we're all right. Three times 20 is 60. This is going to be a very, very vigorous debate, and we're going to have to do it. And we're going to do it, but I suggest everybody in the room, before you get too excited or critical, go find out which of your oxes are about to be gored.
The obviously, a lot of corporations pay much less than the statutory rate at a corporate level. One of the president's proposals is that multinational companies should pay a minimum amount. They shouldn't be able to simply avoid paying taxes by routing their income.
Now, would that include all of the millions of small companies that trade around the world? Would they have to do that too? Or how big or how small? And if you're
there should be a minimum tax rate that companies based here should pay, shouldn't there?
Occasionally the press has raised a lot of hell about somebody that might pay no taxes in a particular year. You know how they got there? They took advantage of deductions that were given to companies to make special investments, to go out and start jobs in special places, to put people to work that otherwise wouldn't work. And to buy bonds here, can you imagine if we take away the ability to buy tax-free municipal bonds and all of that sort of thing? When you put that all together, everything is going to be on the table. And by the way, I pay a lot of tax. I'm going to end up paying some more tax. But my wife, very interesting, she said, Tom, if we just paid another 5%, and I said, wait a minute. First of all, it's 5% on Medicare. It's 5% plus on the Bush deal. It's 5% on what the president's looking for. It's, and on and on and on. And then the states, I noticed this state's upping their deal. When you put it all together, you're looking at what they're talking about is over a 20% increase in taxes. You take that much money out of the productive economy, and you got a real problem.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question. So let me put one to you that's very close to the heart of this area in Silicon Valley, which is internet piracy, subject you brought up before. The defeat of the SOPA Act or bill by a very strong internet lobby looks like it was probably the strongest sort of demonstration so far we've seen of Silicon Valley flexing its Washington muscles. At least that's how it felt from over here. You seem to suggest that actually internet piracy needs to be cracked down on much more strongly. So how did that go across for you in Washington? And are we seeing a new birth of Silicon Valley power in D.C.?
Yes, and that doesn't bother me. They have the right to petition the government. They might be having a bit of a problem with the Congress and the Senate, who were, quite astounded by what they were able to do. But on the other hand, people are doing this now in elections and in selling products. It's a reality of today. I know those people and talk to them regularly. I think a few of us got a little further out on our skis than we should have. They suggest that we go after the pirates through the financial system. That's a possibility. We're all working together to find a new way to get. We had agreed on about 80% of it. To get this part of the bill in a way that is not frightening and doesn't cause serious problems to what they're trying to do. I would further say it's very, very interesting to see all of the challenges that come with a massive expansion of this type of communication, the question of privacy, which most people worry about. This is going to be an extraordinary time for all of us to deal with this, but we can't let those pirates keep doing what they're doing.
But you agree that you went too far out on your skis with this one? And
I said we went too far out on our skis, and I was there.
And do you welcome a stronger Silicon Valley voice in Washington? I mean, what might it lead to?
What might it lead to if we had a stronger union voice or a stronger voice from the business community? I'm not worried about it. As long as they play by the rules, great with me.
Well, on that note, our thanks to Thomas Donohue, President and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the Internet. I'm Richard Waters, and now at this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.